I wanted to just take a few minutes to kind of describe what SB 1070 did and what the Supreme Court has done with SB 1070, and then I'll ask some questions of our panelists, and they can all answer them in whatever way they would like. Briefly, before, so that I don't have to introduce them when they're speaking, because I don't know what order they'll end up speaking in, I'll just want to introduce our panelists. I think you are mostly familiar with them, but Ann Coughlin, to my far right, your left, is teaches criminal law, criminal procedure, and is an expert on police. And she's also the co-author of the criminal law casebook that many of you may have used or may be experiencing now. David Martin in the center teaches immigration law and constitutional law here. He's also the former general counsel to the INS and the former deputy general counsel to the Department of Homeland Security. And then John Harrison is an expert on national security and pretty much everything else that has to do with law. And he served as a counselor on international law to the Office of the Legal Advisor in the State Department for the second Bush administration. So we have a wealth of experience on our panel. So just to start out about the Arizona case, this case was decided very recently in June of 2012, and it was determining whether SB 1070, otherwise known as, I always have to read this, the Support Our Law Enforcement and Safe Neighborhoods Act, was constitutional. Constitutional under the Supremacy Clause. So the issue was not whether the SB 1070 encouraged racial profiling or whether it violated equal protection. Instead, it was whether it was preempted by federal law. And not all of SB 1070 was at issue, just four sections of it. So there are some sections, like the section that that creates penalties for harboring or smuggling an unauthorized immigrant, were not affected by this at all. The four sections that had been preliminarily enjoined by the district court in Arizona and then by the Ninth Circuit and then were at issue before the Supreme Court involved four different, quite different aspects of local and state control over immigration issues. So the first one was Section 3 of the statute, which required legal immigrants to carry registration documents at all times. So if you were here legally but didn't have your documents with you, that would now be criminalized. And the Supreme Court preempted that on a field preemption theory. So what's a field preemption theory? That's where the court says Congress has so occupied this field that any state intervention in it is a problem. The state just can't regulate in this area at all. And the field they identified was registration of aliens. So a fairly narrow field, but they're able to say that Congress has regulated in this area so extensively, so comprehensively, that they've occupied the field, and the state just can't get involved in it at all. Now, this holding is pretty important because one of the theories that the drafters of SB 1070 and other immigration state immigration statutes were using is something referred to as the mirror image theory, or sometimes the cooperation or complementary theory. And the idea there was that if the state is just duplicating what the federal government is already doing, then there's not a problem. There's not a preemption problem if the state just says, well, you require aliens to register, so we're going to say that under state law they're required to also. And the court rejected this theory completely. So at least in the case of alien registration or other subfields of immigration that have been completely occupied by the federal government, the mirror image theory isn't going to work. And there was even a hint in there that it might not work in other cases as well, if the penalty is bigger than, or different than the federal government's penalty. So although the court preempted this on a field preemption theory, they also said that it conflicted with the federal statute because the penalty was bigger than what it was at the federal level. So the state can't mirror the federal government, and it can't do something more extensive than what the federal government has done. The next section that was held to be preempted was Section 5C, which makes it a crime for an illegal immigrant to search for a job or to hold one in the state of Arizona. And here the court said that it was preempted on a conflict or an obstacle preemption theory. The idea here is Congress hasn't occupied the field of employment law. Congress hasn't said only we get to determine the rules of employment in all of the 50 states. States also exercise their authority in this area a lot. But if they were to allow this state law to go forward, it would so conflict with the federal law that it would create an obstacle to the enforcement of the federal law. And I think the specific obstacle they're concerned about is balancing the equities, balancing criminalizing unauthorized employment and deportation, and then also worrying about the discrimination against people who may be suspected of being here illegally, or unfair treatment of workers, even if they are here illegally. And so Congress's scheme criminalized the employment on the employer side and provided civil penalties, including deportation, on the employee side, but didn't criminalize employee unauthorized employment, so that the person who was actually the employee wouldn't have a criminal sanction against them. And Arizona went further, so this was preempted. So the two sections that have gotten the most press are Section 6 and Section 2B, and these are the ones that affect law enforcement. And I think a lot of the interesting issues going forward are going to be how are state courts and legislatures going to read, or how are lower federal courts and state legislatures going to read the fine parsing that the Supreme Court did in determining whether these two sections were preempted. So Section 6 was the warrantless arrest section that said that state police officers could arrest someone without a warrant if they had probable cause to think that the person had committed an offense that made them deportable. In contrast, Section 2B was a reasonable suspicion of illegality provision. So there, if the police officer is already arresting the person for something else, if they suspect that the person is here illegally, then they're required to check and detain them until they've checked. So the Supreme Court said that Section 6, the warrantless arrest provision, was preempted, but that Section 2B was not necessarily preempted. And the difference seems to be a question of cooperation. They say in Section 6, the state of Arizona, the police, are not cooperating with Congress's objectives because they haven't been asked to. They haven't been told by DHS, oh, we suspect that this person may have committed a crime that makes them deportable. Can you arrest them for us? But in the case of 2B, they're going about their own business, conducting their own arrests for some other reason, jaywalking, a broken taillight. There might be lots of pretextual reasons here, but we don't know. And then all they're doing is trying to find out whether this person is here illegally or not. And there's federal legislation on the books that says that you can't prohibit states from trying to cooperate. So it's a question of when are you cooperating and when are you actually enacting your own deportation policy? And that's where they've drawn the line. Now, I think it's really important to notice, and this is one thing that some of our panelists may want to talk about, that this is not upholding Section 2B. The Supreme Court didn't say this is fine necessarily. This was preliminarily enjoined by a district court, so it had not yet gone into effect when the Supreme Court was looking at it. So it was, they rejected the theory that it was facially preempted. They rejected the theory that on any reading this had to be preempted by federal law. But the opinion leaves a lot of leeway for courts to strike it down if Arizona starts enforcing it in a way that might be preempted by federal law. So, for example, in his majority opinion, at one point, Justice Kennedy uses jaywalking as an example of when this might come up and says, imagine someone's jaywalking in Tucson and they have no ID on them. The state courts might conclude, if they look at a case where this person is asked for ID, that unless the person continues to be suspected of some crime for which he may be detained by state officers, it would not be reasonable to prolong the stop for the immigration inquiry. So if what the state of Arizona ends up doing is asking people for ID, and then if they don't have it, if there's no other good law enforcement reason to detain them, letting them go, and then maybe going and trying to find out more about the person on their own, then that might be fine. If they take this person for jaywalking in and detain him for 5 days while they're trying to search records and find out who he is, the implication here that the Supreme Court is saying, I think, is that that would create a constitutional problem. So Section 2B is no longer enjoined. It's going into effect now. The district judge, I think Professor Coughlin has the order, just announced that it's going to be in effect. But we don't know what Arizona is actually going to do with this law. And it seems that they're in a tough position in terms of trying to enforce it in a way that isn't going to bleed over into the lines of what Justice Kennedy has indicated might be a problem. So I'll stop there. I have kind of three sets of questions to direct to the panelists, and then we'll see how much time we have for more. The first will be, what will be the significant legislative effects of this case? So the effects on current legislation, and the 11th Circuit has already come down with some opinions interpreting it on Alabama and Georgia's immigration law, but also for legislators who are trying to draft these sorts of statutes. What are they going to do now that they are constrained in this way? What will the effects be on law enforcement? How are police going to have to go about trying to construe the Arizona law now that they know what the constraints are? And then the foreign affairs implications of this. A lot of the court's language was dependent on the idea that immigration is a quintessentially federal power because of the foreign affairs and national security implications. So let's start with the legislative effects. Maybe Professor Martin would like to begin. What do you think the big effects are going to be?
Well, let me start by putting this in a bit of context. The Arizona law obviously was not a single shot. It was actually part of a fairly extensive campaign that's going on for several years by people who are interested in much more severe enforcement of the federal immigration laws, or frustrated that the federal immigration laws are not enforced more extensively. And they had been looking for a variety of ways and suggesting drafting model provisions, working with legislatures, working with local city councils and others to adopt various kinds of provisions. They tended to follow a couple of patterns, and those are certainly reflected in the four provisions that Professor Abrams outlined. One cluster of issues is the more effective use, as the proponents saw it, of state and local arrest and investigation powers to develop information, to spur greater enforcement, and frankly to deter people from being there because they would be much more likely to encounter a law enforcement official who might be very interested in their immigration status because it might involve a host of local, state and local police as well. So that's one area. The second area is imposing punishment at the state level or sometimes the local level on various kinds of actions that people who are here in unauthorized status are likely to take. Working without authorization, for example, or renting homes in the case of local ordinances in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, and a few other towns around the country. So the effort was to say, well, we're not going to wait for the federal government on that. We're going to say these are violations of state law, and we can go ahead and punish them, whatever may be the federal response, level of interest, lack of interest, whatever it might be. Now, in that framework, with these various efforts going on, the Arizona law, when it was first proposed, it wasn't thought to have a great prospect of enactment. There had been a big flurry, many flurries of legislative activity in Arizona over the past few years, and in the previous round, Arizona had adopted, in the end, just one much more limited provision because a governor named Janet Napolitano had vetoed the provisions that looked much more like what was enacted here, the more ambitious provisions, but had, as a part of her political strategy, had approved a much more narrowly focused law that simply imposed different kinds of punishments on employers and required who hired unauthorized aliens, using an exception to a preemption provision in the federal law that imposes punishments on employers who hire unauthorized aliens, and secondly, required the employers to get involved in the E-Verify, the electronic verification system. That had been approved by the Ninth Circuit by the time all of these issues came up. So the thought back in early 2010 was that maybe had taken the steam out of the legislative effort in Arizona because that law had stood up, and it was pending before the Supreme Court. Ultimately, the Supreme Court upheld that as well, but that was after SB 1070 was enacted. So it wasn't thought that it had a lot of likelihood of passing. Then a rancher was murdered, a rancher with a ranch along the border of Arizona. It was attributed in a big furor. It was attributed to undocumented crossers. That's never been established. But he had been vocal in taking action against unauthorized crossings. And so it was attributed to that. And that got the ball rolling. And suddenly Arizona passes these provisions. I was at the Department of Homeland Security at the time in the General Counsel's office. We were looking at that law that passed in April. And it looked like it had a lot of provisions that could pretty easily be challenged just in our preliminary review, because the first version was much broader than the one that ultimately was challenged. I think the proponents were somewhat surprised that it went through so quickly, and they quickly went back in and enacted amendments about a week later that greatly narrowed the application and made it much more closely parallel to the federal provisions and cut back the scope of police powers that were going to be granted. The original police power provision, for example, said at the time of any lawful contact that a police officer has, if he has reasonable suspicion to believe that somebody's here in an unauthorized way, he shall go ahead and verify the person's status. We thought that, well, that's quite vulnerable, because that would include, well, what's a lawful contact that a police officer can have? A police officer can stop anybody on the street and say, oh, can I ask you a few questions? Moreover, it would involve witnesses, it would involve victims, and we thought, well, this is quite out of keeping with our initial thoughts on a strategy here, that part of the federal government's message is to make foreign visitors feel welcome. That's not at all going to be the case if every time you're stopped by a cop in Arizona, they start probing into your status. So Arizona changed the law, as Kerry said, to focus only on when there's already a lawful arrest, stop, or detention, applying Arizona law. So that's the one area. And then they also had Section 6, which was a bit more expansive, but for anybody who had committed a criminal offense that would make them removable, they could be arrested without a warrant in Arizona. And then the specific punishment provisions, there were more extensive penalties for failure to register, state Arizona penalties for failure to register. They trimmed that back and focused it, and a bit of focusing also on the work provision. So it became a much narrower provision, and the hope obviously was that these provisions might get sustained because they weren't, because of their narrower scope, get sustained by the Supreme Court, and then they could build on this effort in other places. Now, other states went ahead with pretty ambitious provisions, some that went beyond the amended Arizona statute, and so those have been at play. And there certainly are still there will be legislative interest when the legislative season opens up again in January, although I think a lot of the steam will be taken out of it by this. So Kerry mentioned the Alabama and Georgia provisions. After the Supreme Court ruled, the court there essentially struck down most of the provisions that that were included in those laws, except they allowed, at least as against a facial challenge, the continuation of the stop and arrest, the provision that allowed the officer to check immigration status in the case of a lawful arrest if there's a reasonable suspicion that the person is here unlawfully. But let me just highlight one more thing, and then I'll turn it over. The mirror image theory, I think, was a very key part of the strategy adopted by Chris Kobach and the proponents of the Arizona law and laws like that. They really thought that, you know, the feds are always going to be under-resourced or not interested in doing adequate enforcement. If we can simply provide the same provisions, mirror the substantive requirements, but then impose state penalties, we can achieve much more effective enforcement and perhaps deter people or cause some people at least to leave the state, if not to leave the country. So the mirror image theory was very important, and I think we would have seen much wider application. We would have seen, if the court had sustained it, we would have seen people ratcheting up the penalty scheme, maybe reaching a bit more broadly of things that are generally covered by the federal provisions. But the court struck that down pretty decisively, and I think the Georgia and Alabama cases indicate that the courts are going to read Arizona versus United States to strike those down. On the other kinds of provisions, I should say there are other provisions that states had adopted, say, punishing smuggling as a matter of state law, alien smuggling as a matter of state law, although there's a full federal scheme on that. That was actually at issue in the Arizona lawsuit and is at issue in the Arizona lawsuit. It didn't come up on the preliminary injunction hearings. Why not? Because as we looked at it in the federal government, well, now that the issue had been posed, it did seem that the logic of our argument against Section 3, the registration provisions, would also carry to say that it would not be appropriate for the state to have its own punishments of alien smuggling under the same arguments. But the Arizona alien smuggling law had been in effect for several years already, It was slightly modified by SB 1070, but not enacted on that. It wasn't thought credible that one could ask for a preliminary injunction. It has to be stopped now. But it remains alive in the litigation, and then that was also an issue in, I believe, Georgia, and the Georgia anti-smuggling statute was struck down. So I think that's what we'll see. We will see a lot of legislative activity focused on testing how far one can go with the Section 2 type procedure, the checking of immigration status upon a lawful stop, arrest, or detention, applying only state law to make that initial stop.
Other panelists have thoughts on this? On this question?
Yes.
Yes. Go ahead.
One large observation and then two things that follow from it. What the court did in this case was based on preemption, not, as it were, directly on the Constitution. That is, what the consequences for the validity of the Arizona statutes that followed from federal statutes and not from a substantive provision of the Constitution. The federal statutes combined with the Supremacy Clause. And that means two things. First, Congress can change this. And it may be that the gridlock in Congress on a lot of immigration questions will continue, although it's always possible that a major decision can be the impetus for some kind of congressional action. So that's point number one. This is all under Congress's control. The second consequence is for state statutes, perhaps oddly, the farther the state statute gets from what Congress has actually done with respect to immigration and the treatment of aliens present in the United States, the harder it gets to say that what the state has done is invalid, precisely because this is preemption and not the Constitution itself operating, and therefore there has to be some federal statute that either, as the court has been saying for a while, occupies the field, that is, just makes an entire area a federal and not subject to state regulation, or a federal statute that is in the area and has some kind of policy that would be frustrated by state operations. But both of those, again, because this is preemption, require that there be a federal statute in the first place. And so if states act in areas away from, basically, Dave can correct me on this, employment and simple physical presence, which are the two main things that Congress has regulated, it becomes less likely that whatever a state does would be preempted.
Can I just mm-hmm. say a couple words? I think that's right, although I think the Arizona decision foreshadows a pretty robust understanding of field preemption. So the rental ordinances, the ordinances that require local licenses for renting or forbid renting to people who are here without authorization, I think are likely not to stand after this, even though there's not a federal statute of any kind on renting to foreigners. But I totally agree with John's point about how this is preemption. Although we talk about it as a constitutional doctrine, it's really a statutory doctrine, and it's an odd kind of constitutional law because it's something that Congress can change by an enactment. It, to me, puts all the more pressure on finding a way over the next few years to have some better resolution, comprehensive resolution about the immigration problem at the federal level. At some point, I don't think it would happen quickly after this election, but at some point I definitely could see Congress getting so frustrated and feeling so much contradictory pressure from constituencies that they throw up their hands and say, okay, we'll kind of turn the states loose. You guys go do something about that. And if that would happen, there's nothing in the Arizona decision, I don't think. If they were expressly permitted states to adopt their own provisions on this, there's nothing that would bar that. I see that as further down the road, but I do think that's a further reason to say it's really important to be serious about eventual legislative reform at the federal level.
One of the 11th Circuit cases, interestingly enough, did veer off of the preemption theme, and that was the one dealing with Alabama's regulation of school children enrollment. So I don't know how many of you know about this, but one of the things that Alabama did was they said, if you come to a public school, you need to show your birth certificate or your papers, and if you can't, we're going to mark you down as undocumented. And we won't show that information to anyone, but there's federal law saying that they have to share it with the federal government, so it was not a very credible claim that they weren't going to share it. And all of these children didn't enroll in school in Alabama following the passage of this law. So for those of you who've read Plyler versus Doe, Plyler lives, at least according to the 11th Circuit, because they cited Plyler versus Doe, a case from quite a while ago dealing with a statute in Texas that said that children who were here illegally would have to pay tuition in order to go to public school or not go at all. And there, it's a fundamental rights equal protection kind of theory. And so there actually is this one case out there now following the Arizona case that deals with one of these statutes on equal protection theory and not a preemption theory, but only in this really strange context where the power at issue is so clearly, you know, state and local control over education that the preemption theory wouldn't be the most credible way for a court to go. Anne, did you have thoughts on this?
On law enforcement stuff.
Okay, let's move on to law enforcement.
I thought y'all were talking about legislation.
We were.
All that cool stuff.
Tell us about law enforcement.
Okay, so I want to just to frame what's going on a little bit, and when I teach criminal investigation, I often suggest that a wonderful way to approach these materials is from the perspective of the street agent, the police officers on the ground. And right now, police officers, street agents in Arizona are really finding themselves between a rock and a hard place. As Carrie mentioned, I pulled off the computer just before I came down here, the ruling from Judge Bolton on September 5th, clearing the way for Section 2B to be enforced. So as you know from the prior speakers and from reading the case, the Supreme Court strikes down much of SB 1070, but leaves in place Section 2B, which is known as the Papers, Please provision. And after the Supreme Court's ruling, there was more litigation in Arizona, various groups stepping forward and trying to get the judge again to enjoin implementation of Section 2B. And she said, nope, I've read the Supreme Court's opinion. I know that I've got to let this proceed. So within the next couple of weeks, we're told, police officers will begin enforcing Section 2B, the Papers, Please provision. And they are worried for a couple of different reasons. One reason they're worried is because they're not sure how they can enforce this statute without engaging in what we might call racial profiling or ethnic profiling, and we can talk about that question in a minute. So that's the one thing they're worried about, is how can they do this and not get themselves into trouble on that ground. And then the other problem for them, which is a fascinating feature of Section 2B, is Section 2B gives a private right of action to Arizona citizens. They can bring a lawsuit against police agencies if they believe that the police are not fully implementing Section 2B. So the police are worried that whatever they do, they're going to be sued. If they don't get it exactly right, if they don't fully implement, they're going to be sued. And then, of course, if they begin engaging in activity that either violates the Fourth Amendment or amounts to some kind of violation of equality principles, they're going to get sued on the other side. So there's a great deal of anxiety on the street about this question. So when we call it Papers, Please, that's something of a misnomer because it suggests that the cops can just walk up to anybody and say Papers, Please.
Or they say Please.
Well, right. No, they do say Please. That's what we discover in criminal investigation. The Supreme Court justices, to the contrary, the more polite the police are, the more people tend to cooperate. And people will tell the police just about anything when the police are being polite and kind. But my point is a different one. Under this provision, as has already been mentioned, at least the way we're understanding it is that the Arizona police get to check immigration status only in cases where they have another reason to detain the citizen. So they have to have reasonable suspicion for what we call a Terry stop or probable cause to arrest that person for some other crime. Right, so they've got reasonable suspicion that you've committed a crime, probable cause to believe you've committed a crime. They're making a Fourth Amendment seizure for that ground, and then in the course of what they do to process you for that other offense, we now add to the list this verification of immigration status. Okay, so that's the thing to focus on. If in the course of a Terry stop or an arrest for another offense, they develop reasonable suspicion to believe that the person is an illegal alien, at that point, they must take steps to verify. Okay, the other thing that David mentioned, though, that I find very fascinating here is, and again, what's my focus? My focus is to be thinking through Fourth Amendment constraints on law enforcement, okay? Because this is a big issue. The Supreme Court's opinion on Section 2B made clear that it was not going to enjoin the statute on its face, was going to wait to see how it was construed and applied by the state, and its opinion makes clear that it was thinking about Fourth Amendment problems as well, potentially maybe equality problems. So I'm thinking about Fourth Amendment implications. But one thing that's really fascinating to me is it's an accepted feature of Fourth Amendment doctrine that the police are free to walk up to anybody and strike up a conversation and ask any question at all. So as I approach this problem, again, as long as they're not detaining you, seizing you, stopping or arresting you, they're free to walk up to people. Hi, how are you doing? Can I see your papers? That would be outside the bounds of a Fourth Amendment event. And there may be some other, you know, federal reason, some other constitutional reason for saying you can't do this. But as far as the Fourth Amendment's concerned, they're perfectly free to walk up to anybody that they like, strike up a conversation, as long as they don't do anything that suggests that you must remain. So I just want to throw that out there. So then the interesting and difficult questions, as I see this case, are what are going to be the grounds for the initial Terry stop or arrest? And then once they have the person in the Terry stop or arrest mode, what are going to be the grounds that generate a reasonable suspicion that this person is an illegal alien? You get it? So, and you might have concerns at both points, and I take it the police really need to be very careful when thinking through how they're going to approach both of these moments in the encounter. Those of you who've taken criminal investigation know that reasonable suspicion, it's very easy for the police to develop reasonable suspicion. They have to articulate some ground for thinking that this person maybe committed a crime. The person looks fishy in some criminal way. And that's not a difficult quantum of evidence to generate, particularly in our world when just about everything you do is a crime. You know, there's a whole lot of things to pick and choose from. So that's one thing. And then the second thing is, what are the facts that generate a reasonable suspicion that a person's an illegal alien? And it's at this point that you encounter directly the question of whether there will be what we might call racial or ethnic profiling. And I take it one question that I would have is, how could that determination not include a focus on the person's appearance? They look to be Latino or Hispanic, Latina. Their accent, their ability to speak English well. You know, I don't know how it could not include some of those features. So those are the kinds of questions that we need to consider. And the point that I want to emphasize going in, the one thing that I will be on the lookout for is this. What are the grounds for the initial Terry stop or arrest within which the police are then going ahead to make their determination, I've got this further increment of reasonable suspicion to check the immigration status? Are they using the initial Terry stop or arrest as a pretext for that further inquiry? And that's what we've been afraid they've been doing in cases that involve other forms of racial profiling, that is, which targets young black men. So in other words, in a world where everybody violates the traffic laws, I don't know if you're aware of this, but you all do, so any of you is vulnerable, or not any, all of you, 98% of you are vulnerable to being stopped by the police in the course of your day. Police can't stop everybody. They pick and choose who they're going to stop, and we know or we fear or believe that they're making that choice based on their desire to search you for drugs. Who are they going to search for drugs? Who do they want to search for drugs? They often base that decision on race, as well as youth, and maleness, by the way, in case you were wondering. So in any event, the question, would the same thing happen here if the police decided that they really want to get engaged in what David said, this, you know, this effort to make it plain that certain people aren't welcome, are they going to start, you know, making their decision about who to traffic stop based on, oh, what I really want to do is to ask that person for their papers. So that's one thing that we really need to be alert to. And then the other sets of questions that are fascinating to me is, the reason this law is so interesting is I don't know what they do with the information once they have it. Like, it doesn't count as an Arizona violation, right? So I take it that they're going to ditch the information off to you guys, formerly you guys, you know, to the feds, you know, and then you're going to do whatever you do with it. So I then, of course, instantly started looking for Arizona opportunities, right? What is it that the Arizona people could possibly do under state law? So that's an interesting additional question. Do they have any options? One thing that the Supreme Court made clear in its opinion, and Carrie already alluded to this, is it's settled Fourth Amendment doctrine. If they Terry stop you, they get to ask you a bunch of questions about stuff like, you got any drugs in your car? Or, yeah, and to that, I'm not sure what you should say. You know, they get to ask you a bunch of questions. But they can only detain you long enough to process the Terry stop. They can't keep you there, you know, indefinitely. At some point, and it's pretty quick in a Terry stop, they have to let you go. And ditto with an arrest. They can't detain you beyond the ordinary bounds for the arrest. But they're going to have some flexibility. So what I've checked, because I was wondering about this, is whether Arizona has a stop and identify statute on the books, and they do. So in Arizona, if the police are Terry stopping you and they ask you for your name and you refuse to give your name or your truthful name, whatever that means, they can arrest you for that. So it struck me that it would be interesting to watch to see if there were any developments along those lines. If they were being targeted here disproportionately against a certain population, that would be a worry. But this is another power that they have. So these are the things we're going to be watching for. And the police themselves claim that they're really sort of befuddled about how to do this. How can they generate their reasonable suspicion without relying on identity characteristics that are linked to ethnicity or race, right? Is that permissible? And then if they don't go ahead and do this zealously, they're likely to be sued for failing to implement the section.
I think that's real a really helpful way to think about it from the level of from the point of view of the street level police officer who's trying to proceed with this. I think we'll see a couple of very different patterns in Arizona and in other states with similar kinds of laws that at least are initially upheld. And I've encountered in the work that I've done, I've worked with lots of different sheriff's offices, police chiefs, really different attitudes on there. On the one hand, there will be some like Sheriff Joe Arpaio, you probably heard of him from Maricopa County, eager to use the full range of police authorities in a quest to ferret out anybody who's here unlawfully. And there's now a couple of private lawsuits and a civil rights division investigation and lawsuit into his practices. But I think that kind of a sheriff's department with that kind of attitude will be using the full range of this and didn't need SB 1070 or the threat of private suits for failure to enforce sufficiently to go forward with that. It's really the opposite kind of problem. But there are a lot of other sheriffs and police chiefs in Arizona, in my impression, actually most of them, who really are quite concerned about this law from the other point of view. What do they do? And they do not want to overuse police authorities in this way, in a way that discourages cooperation with police on regular, ordinary crime fighting. So the police chief of Tucson actually has been very vocal and thoughtful on these kinds of issues. So we'll see how that goes forward. And that's where this curious civil suit provision may come in. And it's a civil suit provision that provides for if a citizen suit successfully proves that the police department is not sufficiently enforcing immigration laws, including state and federal, I believe it applies, they could be subject to a fine. The municipality would be subject to a fine of between $500 and $5,000 a day for failure to proceed. The federal government tried to make a lot of that particular provision before the Supreme Court to say that's why it's not just a sort of ordinary provision for checking papers in ways that sometimes the federal government actually likes police departments to cooperate in checking some of the people that they arrest. This puts such an emphasis for the state to be very aggressive in doing that, lest the municipality lose $5,000 a day, that it should make a difference. Anyway, the Supreme Court didn't really focus on that argument at all, but we'll, going forward, we'll see what happens with that. Now, the Tucson police chiefs are not going they're not going to instruct their officers to go out and just sort of strike up conversations to go forward. And SB 1070, as amended in that 1 week later version, does not call for that. It's only if there's already a separate stop, arrest, or detention. But it does offer other possibilities for officers which existed before, for officers who were more of the Joe Arpaio type to go out and ask those kinds of questions. I do think what will primarily happen, though, is the way in which these are checked, there does need to be a check with the federal government for an ultimate decision or at least preliminary determination about the person's immigration status. There's a separate system that's being rolled out, you may have heard about it, called Secure Communities, that provides, it only attaches at the time of arrest. So they're brought down, you're being booked in, fingerprints are taken. There is an automatic link from the FBI receiving the fingerprints to immigration databases to check the person's status. It's got some limitations, but it's pretty important and effective. And that actually is a much more efficient way of proceeding. And in a way, many people from the left have attacked Secure Communities. I think that's a profound mistake. That's a much better way, although it's certainly got some issues, it can be improved, but it's a much better way to focus enforcement efforts, not on somebody who's just subject to a Terry stop by the side of the road, but by people who've actually done something that gets them into an arrest and booking situation, and then provides a fairly efficient way. And the other thing about Secure Communities is everybody who's arrested is checked against that database. Everybody, if their name is David Martin, John Harrison, or Jose Garcia, everybody's fingerprints, once they're booked in, are checked in that way. So that part eliminates the profiling. Then from that point, an expert immigration officer makes a determination about whether the person is likely to be here in unauthorized status.
I wanted to just make one other quick point that I didn't highlight in my opening remarks. For those of you who haven't taken immigration law, I think one important thing that's underlying a lot of this is that it's often difficult to tell what someone's status is. So with the jaywalking example, for a lot of people, it would be easy. If I jaywalk and I happen to be a U.S. citizen and I happen to be carrying my driver's license with me, they'll be able to identify me pretty quickly, and they could probably identify my citizenship fairly quickly. For someone who has no identification whatsoever, it's going to take a while because it's possible that they have applied for asylum, but their case is pending, and it could take years for a case to get resolved. So there are many statuses. Someone might be have applied to get a green card based on a marriage, but the case hasn't been adjudicated yet, so it looks like their visa is expired. But you know, there could be lots of cases in which someone technically does not have legal papers. It's not as if we all have a national ID card that says what our status is at any time. And yet the federal government's determination could be, we aren't interested in this person. In fact, it's our fault because it's been taking a long time that this person doesn't have papers. Or they might find out about them and then decide to grant them some sort of relief. So these cases can be really confusing. And I think one of the policing issues may be, how are local and state police supposed to know enough about immigration law to make any sort of determination in these borderline gray area cases about what the federal government would want in a given situation? In the cases that aren't clear cut, there's a lot of discretion that has to be exercised, and it's not really their discretion to exercise.
Two thoughts. First, just to show that there's a federal court's angle to everything, I want to mention, for those of you who have this vague notion that citizen suits aren't permissible, as some of you may have encountered in a number of places, maybe federal courts, maybe environmental law. And so what's going on in Arizona? Well, actually, citizen suits aren't permissible in federal court. The Supreme Court has developed that or placed limits on them, and this sort of thing would probably be impermissible in federal court, but has placed limits on citizen suits on the theory that there are jurisdictional limits under Article 3 to what a court can do. Well, Article 3 governs federal courts and not state courts, And so, interestingly, this is not the first time this particular thing has come up with respect to Arizona. States are allowed to have their courts entertain kinds of lawsuits where the federal courts would say the plaintiff doesn't have standing, which is what they might well say in a situation like that. But states can have a different rule. And that then creates a tricky question. Does the Supreme Court of the United States have appellate jurisdiction if a state court decides a federal question in one of these proceedings that isn't a federal case at all, because it could come into the state court and not into Article III? And there is a case about that from about 25 years ago from Arizona, just to demonstrate this is not the first time that Arizona law has created the situation where a plaintiff who would not have standing in federal court does have standing in state court. As I say, I just couldn't resist the Fed Court's interlude part.
Who's the citizen you're imagining? Like if I'm a citizen of Arizona and I don't want to have to carry my birth certificate around with me?
No, I'm thinking the person who is just generally outraged and spends
so
a lot of time
of
on the internet
connection.
Getting outraged, and so wants to sue. That's the kind
that
of person
could
be you too. That's the kind of person who doesn't, as the federal courts would say, have standing, but does in Arizona and can in an Arizona court. My Fourth Amendment question is, and Ann and Dave both know a lot more about this than I do, but there are some investigative tools. I mean, this is picking up on the point Dave was making right at the end about secure communities. There's some investigative tools that operate by being over-inclusive, that mm-hmm. operate by stopping mm-hmm. every 10th person or
yep.
everybody.
Yep.
And if you were an Arizona law enforcement
yep.
officer who wanted simultaneously, because you're in a very tight spot, between the citizen suit provision and the possibility of, for example,
yep.
engaging in racial profiling.
Yep.
If you find yourself in that tight spot, the solution might be exactly something like that.
Yeah, ask everybody.
Hmm.
Right. That's my first thought, too. Just routinely ask everybody. And I don't see, as a matter of Fourth Amendment doctrine, they probably could do that.
Be like going to the airport every day.
Yeah. but only if you're being terror stopped. Right?
No, I mean, right. Ask everybody, even.
Oh.
Yeah.
You mean at a checkpoint?
Yeah, for example.
Oh, yeah, sure. Checkpoints, yep. Fine.
That would be an interesting solution because it might create enough political opposition. That
yes, that's exactly right. That was
a lot.
I had thought that, too.
Yeah. Let's move on to the foreign affairs aspects of the case. You want to start with that?
Yeah, I have a couple of, maybe it's three things to say about that. And the first thing is that it's always difficult when you read any judicial opinion, but especially sort of the Supreme Court of the United States generates opinions that are an art form in this matter, in this respect, to sort out the actual reasons from the parts that are not actual reasons. And that's especially true here with respect to the influence of foreign relations concerns on what the court did. And this case, I think, is typical in that respect. Often what the court, especially the Supreme Court, says about any topic that might make you think it influenced the court's decision, sometimes that's just boilerplate. It's just in there because prior cases talked about that as being important, whether or not that's an important factor in what the court has just done. The second, something might well be in there for us and not for the justices. That is to say, for its rhetorical effect, and in order to persuade the reader, and not because it persuaded the decision makers. And I think there's some of both of those, just plain boilerplate, some rhetoric, specifically about the fact that this is a foreign relations question, and therefore it should be a question determined by the federal government. But I also think it's true that in this case and in cases like it, the justices are to some extent genuinely influenced by the idea that what the states do here has implications for the foreign relations of the United States, and that's important. And once you've said that, though, that then sort of opens up some new questions that are also difficult to sort out. Okay, they're concerned about the foreign relations aspect of this. And one interesting feature of Justice Kennedy's opinion for the court is that, and I think this is unsurprising, but this suggests you never know what's really driving people either the judges or people in the executive branch who are making arguments to the judges. The aspect of United States foreign relations law that, or foreign relations of the United States that the court focuses on have to do with the treatment of aliens who are in the United States. And obviously that's a very important question of foreign relations. And one thing that anybody in the federal government who's involved with this sort of thing knows is that the way the United States treats aliens in the United States has real consequences for the way U.S. citizens are treated in other countries. And so, yes, that is totally an important question. And I think it is one that, clearly drove the justices and as I say, drives the executive branch. A trickier question is whether either the justices or the executive branch are concerned about the impact not of the way the United States treats aliens in the United States, but of United States immigration policy on other countries. And that, too, is a sensitive matter, although between the United States and a substantially smaller number of countries, basically any other country, is likely to have some of its nationals here in the United States at some point, and so be concerned about how they are treated. It's a smaller number of countries for whom U.S. immigration policy is an important question in their relations with the United States. That's obviously an extremely delicate question, and it is something I suspect influences people who are concerned about the foreign relations aspect of state conduct in this kind of question, whether or not they are prepared to say it. And so you are more likely to hear discussions of the first foreign affairs aspect of it, treatment of aliens, and other countries might not like U.S. immigration policy, because if someone says that, it's natural to say, well, yes, it is the other country's business how their nationals are treated in the United States. It is not the other country's business whether they're allowed to come here in the first place. And people are going to have quite different reactions on that, and it's the latter, I think, that gets people to start talking about, for example, so-called heckler's vetoes. So keeping those two separate is important. The really hard thing I find in sorting out exactly what's going on, once you think, as I say, I think I do, that the impact of all this on the foreign relations of the United States clearly influences the judges and here the justices, is how much, and this is one of the hard questions in preemption, how much does it influence what they think Congress wants? So how much does it cause them to make sort of genuine judgments about congressional policy and do sort of what preemption analysis is designed to do? And how much are they independently influenced by it? And one of the things that I think often happens, and you know, I don't have as much experience in this area as Dave Martin, but I have some. One thing that I think often happens in federal court litigation, especially in the courts of appeals and the Supreme Court, is that the executive branch, the Justice Department and the State Department together, are able to persuade the judges that something would be bad for the foreign relations of the United States. They persuade them not that Congress thinks that this would be bad for the foreign relations of the United States, but that it would be bad for the foreign relations of the United States. And of course, in a preemption case, that too is something they can't fully articulate, because the rationale for what they're doing, everything has to be attributed to Congress. Even if what's to some extent going on is they've been persuaded by sort of a freestanding substantive foreign relations argument, as I think they often are. And one consequence of all of that is that why are there law professors to explain to you things that are not on the surface of judicial decisions? One of the difficult things to do in a situation like this is to sort out what's actually driving the justices. And as I say, I think they are to some extent driven by their views about what's good for the foreign relations of the United States, but they have to say, and Congress has a policy along those. I'm not the first person to observe this, but I think it's important, and it's important because it affects sort of the practical relationship between the courts and the executive branch. Because a lot of what's going on is the courts are looking to the executive branch to be told what's good and what's not good for the foreign relations of the United States, and the executive branch is happy to do that. And wants to persuade them on these sort of freestanding grounds and not just on grounds that Congress wanted something.
I'd add a reflection on that. I think, again, that's a really helpful way to look at it. But in this area, the way the court ties in an ultimate conclusion about what would be good or bad for foreign policy to what Congress thinks is, in this particular field, is basically I think what the court did here was to say, well, the executive branch has a fair amount of discretion in making these sorts of decisions. It's the federal government, not the Arizona government, that makes those calls. Why? Because Congress assigned it in that way, knowing that there would be foreign affairs effects, and they intended for these authorities to be executed, carried out in a way that was sensitive to that. And, I mean, there's a wonderful old quote from Federalist III, even about, well, we want to have some of these powers to be federal powers because otherwise border states might have different views and they'd get us into foreign quarrels that the rest of the country doesn't want to be involved in. And I do think that's basically a key part of what is going on. And from the standpoint of those who tried to shape the federal government's argument, well, we were, one, very much aware of the importance of presenting foreign policy arguments. There was a very lengthy declaration filed by the Deputy Secretary of State about the impact of the Arizona law on various foreign relations matters. Part of it clearly was awareness that foreign affairs is an area where the court is, if they're persuaded that there's an issue, they're very likely to take a view that leans quite favorably to the federal government in a preemption challenge. Now, that evoked a response, and I'd just like to spell out a little bit more about the heckler's veto argument in case you didn't entirely follow that. A lot of people, after that affidavit was filed, they said, oh, look, you're handing over, the State Department's handing over our immigration policy to foreign governments. If they scream loud enough, they get to veto what our lawful democratic processes internally want to establish. And the court, ultimately, they didn't deal with it in those terms, but they accepted, basically, the structure about the foreign affairs implications. And that, I would like to say one quick thing, that maybe you're going to open it up quickly to questions, but that leads to just one comment on the very distinctive view that Justice Scalia offers in his dissent, which was quite a vehement dissent on a lot of different levels. But the key part of it is that he said that striking down most of Arizona's law, in doing that, the majority, he said, quote, deprives states of what most would consider the defining characteristic of sovereignty, the power to exclude from the sovereign's territory people who have no right to be there. Now, for Scalia to be very interested in a strong understanding of state sovereignty is not surprising. Justice Kennedy is often in that position as well, the author of the majority opinion. But really to say that most would consider it the defining character of sovereignty of a state within the United States, the power to exclude people who have no right to be there, I don't think most people have that notion. That's been clearly established in Supreme Court precedent since 1876, that part of sovereignty is really for the federal government to decide, not for the states to decide. And he went on from there to say a good deal more. But I was quite struck, and it seemed to me really out of keeping with some earlier decisions that Scalia had authored that seemed to emphasize the federal government's prosecutorial discretion. But it was quite a striking approach, and it was one that he felt so strongly about, he actually read much of his opinion from the bench, highlighting those particular themes that morning.
Thank you.